United States against Davis. Mr. Cox.
May it please the court, co-counsel. Johnny Cochran uttered the famous eight words during the O.J. Simpson trial: if the glove don't fit, you must acquit. The word must is significantly different than the word should. To tell a jury that they must do something, must acquit, is a proper statement of the law. Patrick Davis went to trial in front of Judge Clover. And as the briefs make clear and as this court understands, the jury instruction indicates, the pattern instruction indicates, that if the government has failed to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt, the jury should acquit.
Okay. So here's my question. From the transcript that's attached to the brief, it appears that the court decided to use the pattern instruction with the word should in both parts of the instruction. And then what happened was that the court inexplicably used the word must in both parts. When the court misspoke, did the defendant object? And if not, we have a plain error review, right?
We made a very clear record of this at the district court level, Your Honor. It was the defense request to change the word from should to must. And so it was us that requested that the pattern instruction be changed so that the language would be, if the government has failed to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt, you must acquit. And Judge Clavert agreed that that was a proper statement of the law. In response to our request, the government then said, Judge, if we have proven our case, we're asking that you use the word must convict, at which point we objected on behalf of Mr. Davis, indicating that that was not a correct statement because a jury always retains the power to nullify. Judge Clavert disagreed. He put the instruction, he created the instruction with the government's requested additional modification and said you must convict, you must acquit. The issue we're raising on appeal is that that's an incorrect statement of the law, and because it vitiates the jury's responsibilities, it's not subject to an harmless error review.
You were very careful to distinguish all the government's cases except for one, and that was the Eighth Circuit's opinion in Crow. Would we have to split from the Eighth Circuit to find in Mr. Davis's favor? Because they seem to have no problem with the word must in the conviction part of the instruction.
Well, I think there already are inconsistencies if we look at the different cases that are cited in the briefs. The D.C. Circuit, for example, says that you would never instruct in so many words for a jury to convict, but you would, of course, tell them that they must acquit if the government has failed to prove its case. And we think the Sixth Amendment certainly supports our argument because we have general verdicts in criminal cases, and so the jury is the ultimate finder of guilt. And so the proper statement of law, we believe, is that the jury must acquit if the government has not proven its case beyond reasonable doubt. It's the same reason why this court doesn't endeavor to define reasonable doubt. We just say that it's its own self-defining concept, and we leave it at that, rather than murky the waters and upset this carefully aligned balance that we've created. And I think that's what happened here, is there is a carefully defined balance that's been created over many, many years. And certainly the Constitution requires proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and if the government has not met that burden, a jury must acquit. They don't have any...
Yeah. What I kept thinking is, how does Mr. Davis show any harm? I'm on to something else, because the time is up. But how does he show any harm from the joinder? When he was acquitted not only of the joint counts, but also on one of the bank robbery counts. Another, you know, if the jury was influenced by the evidence of violence, why didn't it tar him on all four robbery counts, bank robbery counts?
That's a good question, Your Honor. Our concern here really with the joinder was that these are initially very separate types of offenses. We have bank robberies that didn't involve firearms, and then we had some number of months later a very violent shooting that took place that was unrelated in our arguments to the bank robberies. And so I think there is a very real prejudice when a jury is hearing testimony throughout the trial of bank robberies that were basically note job, I use that expression, note job bank robberies with no display of firearm. And then they're also hearing evidence of Mr. Davis shooting up a house. They're hearing about bullets in trucks. The jurors are hearing about bullets in bedroom walls. None of that evidence, in our opinion, would have been admissible at the bank robbery trials. The issue in the bank robbery was whether the identification was correct, whether this is the person who robbed the banks. And so evidence of the shooting and the violent character, all that 404B evidence wouldn't have been admissible to prove any sort of motive or intent to rob banks or even that Mr. Davis was the perpetrator of the bank robberies. To answer your question more specifically, I certainly don't know why the jury did what it did, but I think we do have a very serious problem here with the misinstruction that took place, and I think that cuts to the core of the issues that we're dealing with here in this case. We do think there is significant prejudice, though, when evidence of such violent behavior is introduced against Mr. Davis, that there is a spillover effect that can occur, and we would ask for reversal on both grounds. If there's no other questions, I'll rely on my briefs.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, counsel. Ms. Watzke.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court. Kelly Watzke on behalf of the United States. I guess I'll begin, Judge Rovner, with addressing the issue that you raised, which I think is spot on. I don't see any way that Mr. Davis can establish that he was actually prejudiced, which is his burden in this case, when the jury acquitted not only on the two witness tampering charges, but the first bank robbery charge. If there was some sort of prejudicial spillover effect to be had from them hearing evidence of the shooting, one would certainly expect that they would have convicted on that bank robbery, that first bank robbery count. I think there's other evidence in the record that also demonstrates that this jury was able to compartmentalize the evidence as to each of these counts and make the decision independent. And that is the question that the jury asked. Actually, it was more of a statement that the jury made during its deliberations, and that's found at page 746 of the transcript. The jury said, essentially, if we believe that the discharge of the weapon was related to retribution for an unrelated event versus intimidation, then count five is affected. And I think what that shows is that there's evidence here that the jury believed that Mr. Davis was probably involved in a shooting. They just thought the shooting was related to something other than trying to intimidate Andronika Moore and prevent her from continuing to cooperate with law enforcement. So I submit to the court that if they believed he was involved in a shooting but they nevertheless acquitted him of counts five and six, this is not a jury that was easily maneuvered, I guess, by prejudicial or arguably prejudicial information. So I don't think that Mr. Davis can establish actual prejudice. That's his burden here. Turning to the issue of jury nullification, this court, Your Honors, and other courts have held that nullification is not a right of the jury. It's not a right of the defendant. And essentially, it's a lucky circumstance for some defendants, but it doesn't create an entitlement to what is essentially an unlawful verdict, or in this case, a do-over based upon speculation or mere possibility that the jury could nullify. Mr. Davis argues, or Mr. Cotton on behalf of Mr. Davis argues, that there is a significant difference between the terms should and must, and I'll concede that those terms are not identical, but as this court held in the Curley decision, they both are directives. They both suggest imperative commands, and so I don't think there is a meaningful distinction here. And I think it's important to know or to note that the use of the term must in the jury charge in this case was certainly not an isolated incident. This jury was told, for example, in other parts of the instructions that they must follow the instructions, even if they disagree with them. They're told that they must only base their decision on the basis of the evidence before them. They must disregard publicity. They must return a fair and impartial verdict that has nothing to do with impermissible reasons like bias or sympathy. And so we tell juries all the time that they must do certain things, and yet we also know that juries have the option of disregarding those directives, just like they do when they opt to nullify. But that is not a compelling reason to sort of shy away from telling them that they must fulfill their oath and they must follow the law. And we don't shy away from the use of the term must in those circumstances, and the same should be true here. I think that there was no error here for Judge Clavert to say, if the government has satisfied its burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, then you must find the defendant guilty. There's no compelling reason why jurors should not be encouraged to fulfill their oath and follow the law. Unless the court has any particular questions, I will simply ask the court to affirm.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Cotton?
Very briefly, Judge.
Certainly there must be a significant difference between the word should and must, or the government would not have made the request at the...
Or you think there should be a significant difference?
I think there should be a significant difference between the two words, and I think there is a significant difference between them. Telling a jury that they should acquit a defendant implies that there is the option not to acquit if the government hasn't proven its case beyond reasonable doubt. And I think that's why Judge Clavert agreed that the word must needs to be inserted into the pattern instruction. And if there were no distinction between those words, then certainly the government at the trial court level wouldn't have asked for the modified instruction reflecting that they must convict. I think this case presents an opportunity for a bright-line rule to be created for exactly these types of cases that come up on appeal. There is the power of juries to nullify. The jury instruction as currently written does not accurately reflect the fact that a jury must acquit if a defendant is, if the government hasn't proven its case. And so this case really is an opportunity to create that bright line rule that, yes, juries should convict if the government has proven its case, but they must acquit if the government has not proven its case beyond a reasonable doubt. We would ask that the court reverse the convictions.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. We appreciate